going to add one verse to the scripture reading today from Romans 12, verse 1. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your whole selves, body, mind, and spirit, your whole selves, as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. Holy, H-O-L-Y, holy and acceptable to God. This is your spiritual worship. And then from 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 13 through 16, prepare your minds for action. Discipline yourselves. Set all your hope on the grace that Jesus Christ will bring you when he is revealed. Like obedient children, do not be conformed to the desires that you formerly had in ignorance, but instead, as he who called you is holy, be holy yourselves. H-O-L-Y, be holy yourselves in all your conduct, for it is written, you shall be holy because I am holy. God speaking. Holiness. The Lord always blesses the reading of the scripture. There was along the ocean a stretch of very rocky and treacherous coastline, and many ships were sunk in that area, and many people were injured and many lives were lost. And so a group of people who lived in that area decided that they would build a lighthouse, and they decided they would also build a rescue center, and they did. The lighthouse gave light so that all of the ships and the boats could find direction. And the rescue center went out and rescued people, brought them in, treated them for their injuries, nurtured them, helped them get back on their feet again. This image of a lighthouse and rescue center captures for me the biblical meaning of holiness. As both Paul and Peter emphasize, holiness is when we let the light of Christ shine through our conduct and become a light for others that brings them comfort and enlightenment. That's holiness. Holiness is when the light of Christ shines through our conduct, through the words we say, through our actions, and it gives direction and comfort and enlightenment for others. And Paul and Peter both say that we shall be holy. That's our primary responsibility, to let that light shine through us. So I like that analogy. Now, the story about that lighthouse continues, though. Here's what happened. In this particular lighthouse, at first, in order to do their work most effectively and most efficiently, they decided they needed to have good organization. And so they developed a hierarchy, and they developed committees, and they developed plans, and they developed an organization. And then they found that the more they worked together to rescue people and to keep the lighthouse going, the more they discovered that they liked being with each other and they liked working together. And so they began to have potluck dinners, and they began to have small groups, and they began to have training. So they had classes so that they could learn all about how to operate the lighthouse. And they learned all about how they could go out and rescue people. And pretty soon they decided they liked their classes better than they liked the actual work of rescuing people. And then they discovered that, you know, all of those people that they were bringing in, you know, they weren't quite the people they wanted in their rescue center because they were getting the carpet messed up. And they didn't seem to, you know, they weren't clean. I mean, they were coming in wet and they were coming in dirty and they were coming in with all these emotional problems. And they decided that they needed to maybe focus more on themselves and make their lighthouse and their rescue center to where they liked it better. And they had developed certain traditions and certain practices that were so meaningful to them. They had annual events and they had holiday celebrations in their rescue center. And those became very important to them. And pretty soon it was discovered that the lighthouse and the rescue center were not doing quite the good that they were at first. And so there was a group of people in the organization, and they said, you know, our real purpose is to be a lighthouse and to be a rescue center, to let that light shine so that we can give direction and we can give comfort to the people that are crashing on our seacoast, because crashes were still going on, wrecks and shipwrecks and all of that. And so they went up the coast and they built a new lighthouse and they built a new rescue center. And you know where this is going, don't you? And pretty soon they decided they needed to be organized and they needed to be trained and they liked working with each other. And pretty soon that second lighthouse and that second rescue center, people were so involved with themselves, they so much liked each other, and they so much liked the ways of their rescue center and the ways of their lighthouse, that pretty soon people were losing their lives at sea and ships were not being given good direction. And so another group split away. And now the story is that there are lighthouses and rescue centers all up and down that coast, and hardly anybody is actually rescuing anyone. Well organized, but almost no rescues. So I think that's an important story, because not only does the concept of a lighthouse and a rescue center help us understand what it means to be holy, but this parable about all of these lighthouses and rescue centers up and down the coast, and they all seem to be losing track of why they got started in the first place, that's kind of the story of church history. And I want to talk about that a little bit, because we're a church and we have a history, and we're a church that is in a particular denomination that used to be in a denomination that was a result of a merger of other denominations. And so I want us to take a look at our own story. Because as Jesus says, we must take the log out of our own eye before we take the speck out of the eyes of our brothers or sisters. So let's just take a look at our own story. Let's not get all guilty or all defensive. Let's just be curious and take a look at the story. And our story, the story of our church right here, Geneseo Grace, in this spot, actually started, the key part of the story started about 400 or 500 years ago, actually. All right? And it started in Germany and it started in England, particularly our roots as Grace United Methodist Church. Now, in England, there was the established church, sort of like the established lighthouse and the established rescue center. It was known as the Church of England. And it was sort of the institutional religion going on in England. But starting particularly in the 16 and 1700s, there were a number of people in England who thought the church has kind of lost the reason it exists in the first place. And so we see a lot of protesting movements starting out in England. So protesting the Church of England that had kind of gotten too comfortable, too clubbish, too cliquish, were groups such as the Puritans and the Quakers and the Baptists and the Presbyterians and the Methodists. There were these various groups that were protesting that the Church of England had lost its holiness, its ability to let the light of Christ shine through the conduct of individuals and of the group itself. Because at times it seemed as though the community had become most unholy. It wasn't the light of Christ that was shining through the way people were acting. It was the fires of the devil. And people didn't want to be a part of that organization. They were officially a part of it because they lived in England, but they didn't want to be a part of it. And so these protesting groups began to offer alternatives. And particularly, they talked about holiness, all of them, so that the light of Christ had to shine through your conduct. And that was how you were a blessing then to other people and how you loved God. Well, it was very dangerous through the 1600s, particularly in England, to be a protesting group. In fact, that was a good way to get yourself killed, was to be a Puritan or to be a Quaker. And it was a good way in the 1700s to get roughed up if you were a Methodist, which was part of a protesting group. And so that's what was going on in England. The clubbish Church of England, for the most part, and these protesting groups, and it was very dangerous. In Germany, the same thing was going on. Now, in Germany, in the 1700s, Germany was not the one nation that we know today. Germany, in fact, was a collection of separate states through the 1700s and even early 1800s. Places like Bohemia, Bavaria, and Prussia, and so forth. But there were a collection of individual states. There was a common language and a common culture, but politically, Germany was not united. And whoever the king was in each of these little kingdoms got to decide what the official religion was. So in southern and western Germany, it was Roman Catholic. In northern and eastern Germany, it was either the German Reformed Church, patterned after John Calvin, or the Lutheran Church, patterned after Martin Luther. And I'm going to put the Catholics aside. Please don't be offended, but I'm going to put the Catholics aside for a moment because they are not germane to our situation. But in these states, in Germany, where the official religion was either the German Reformed Church or the Lutheran Church, over time, these official churches got a little clubbish, a little cliquish, very institutional. And so just as in England, protesting movements developed, so in Germany, protesting movements developed to try to reform the Lutheran Church and the German Reformed Church. And at that point, we see such groups as the Mennonites arising, and groups such as the Dunkers arising, and groups known as the Pietists arising, and groups known as the Schreckenfelders arising. Is there anybody here that's a Schreckenfelder or used to be? All right. So you got to go home and Google that, don't you now, to figure out what a Schreckenfelder is. So there probably were a couple around here. So these protesting religions began in Germany to protest the official, the emptiness and the sort of the flatness of the official German Reformed Church and the German Lutheran Church. And it was just as dangerous to be a religious protesting movement in Germany as it was to be one in England. There were wars that were fought through the 1600s and the 1700s. And people were executed for being part of these protesting religious movements. Now, as you're, if you're thinking history at this point, and you're interested in American history, you're thinking, okay, this is about the time that England was establishing colonies in the New World, in America, all right? So, in the early 1600s, when the Massachusetts Bay Colony was established, which is now consists of the states of Massachusetts and Maine, when the Massachusetts Bay Colony was established, it was the Puritans that wanted to get out of England because it was dangerous for them to be a protesting religion in England. And so they were the backbone of establishing the state of the colony of Massachusetts. And they came over, A, so that they could be safe from the authorities telling them that they couldn't be Puritan in their practice of religion. They also, when they came over, wanted to find a place where they could be in charge and make other people do what they said. And so that was the establishment of religion, particularly congregational churches that had strong Puritan influence in Massachusetts. In Maryland, let me go back to the Roman Catholics for a moment. It could be very deadly to be Roman Catholic in certain places of Germany and in certain places of England by this time. And so Maryland was established as a safe place for Roman Catholics to come, where they would not be persecuted or killed for their faith. And in addition to welcoming Roman Catholics, Maryland welcomed other religions as well. Now, the most interesting colony of them all, however, and this is partly where our church comes in, the most interesting colony of them all was Pennsylvania. William Penn got a charter from the King of England. William Penn was a Quaker, and it was very dangerous in England to be a Quaker. And so William Penn, who happened to be friends with the king, talked to the king into giving him a charter so that he could come to the New World and start a colony, and he named it after himself, Pennsylvania. And so Pennsylvania originally was a place where Quakers could come from England and be safe and practice their religion. Now, William Penn also wanted to allow anybody from any country to come to Pennsylvania who was a part of a protesting religion and be safe there. And so from a religious perspective, Pennsylvania is the most interesting state in the whole country, because people came to Pennsylvania from England, from Germany, and from a number of other places in order to practice their protesting religion. They believed that you had to have freedom to be holy. You had to have freedom to be able to emphasize that this is what Christianity is about. And so flocking to Pennsylvania were the Schweckenfelders and the Quakers and the Methodists and the English Baptists and the German Dunkers and the Mennonites. And by the way, the Amish split off from the Mennonites because they thought the Mennonites weren't holy enough. And they all came to Pennsylvania and established their religions there, these protesting religions. And the emphasis for all of them was holiness. And it was interesting because at first they all got along with each other. The Mennonites, the Quakers, they learned from each other at first as they settled into Pennsylvania. Now back to the lighthouse parable. Over time, each of these protesting religions became institutional. There was a group called the Methodists. When they were in England, they protested that the Church of England wasn't holy enough, and so John Wesley, who was the leader, the founder of the Methodist movement, established some rules for holiness. He said, no brawling, no drunkenness, no owning of slaves, no wearing of costly apparel. Ladies, take your gold and your silver off. Inappropriate to be flashy with money. We must be modest. It's okay to earn money. We must save it, however, and give most of it away. That was holiness in John Wesley. Oh, and by the way, one of his rules was no evil talking about ministers. I do not know what happened to that. But there were these rules of holiness that John Wesley had. Now, John Wesley operated among the English-speaking people, trying to promote holiness. A man by the name of Philip Otterbein, I believe we have a room named after him, he was working to reform the German Reformed population in Pennsylvania and in Maryland. A man by the name of Jacob Albright, we have an Albright room here, he was working to reform the German Lutheran people. They were all in Pennsylvania, Maryland. They would interact with each other. But the Methodists primarily worked on reforming the English-speaking religions. And Otterbein and Albright worked on reforming the German-speaking population in Pennsylvania and Maryland. Eventually, John Wesley's descendants became the Methodist Church, and they became very established and very institutional in a short time. Albright's followers established the Evangelical Association. And by the way, that's where this church comes from. And Otterbein's followers established what were known as the United Brethren Church. And it did not take long for these churches to also become institutionalized. Remember the parable of the lighthouses along that seacoast. Along about 1840, another movement started, particularly among the Methodists, the Evangelicals, and the United Brethren. Another movement started around the 1840s known as the Holiness Movement. And that movement stayed strong for over 100 years. And the reason I know a little bit about that movement is because my grandparents were solid in it. And that's what nurtured Christianity for me. That's the movement that introduced me to Jesus Christ. So that's why I know a little bit about it. But the Holiness Movement, they didn't necessarily leave the churches and form a new church. They almost always stayed within the Methodist churches or within the Evangelical churches or within the United Brethren churches and influenced from within, continually reminding people to let the light of Christ shine through their conduct, that was the way to abundant life. And that was the way to be a blessing to other people, letting the light of Christ shine through our conduct. So here are all these people in the Holiness Movement. And over time, they tried to teach people the ways of holiness. Now, one of the things, by the time my grandparents came along, and by the time they were teaching me things, here's some of the stuff they taught me. No alcohol. Alcohol touches your lips, straight to hell. No tobacco. They didn't even know about other drugs. No sex. Don't even say the word. There were no debates over LGBTQ+, because it was all bad in terms of what I was taught. There's no need to single anybody out. And no dancing, no card playing, no shooting pool, no using certain language, no no flashy riches. Women, my great-grandmother never cut her hair. Women were not supposed to cut their hair. And on and on. Now, they were not just concerned about the conduct of the individual, but the holiness movement was also concerned about our conduct in society. The holiness movement led the fight against slavery. It was wrong to own or buy or sell slaves or be involved in any way in the slave business. The holiness movement led the way in women having rights, including the right to vote. The holiness movement led the way in eliminating child labor. The holiness movement led the way in establishing prohibition, trying to deal with problems that were going on in families. The holiness movement led the way in establishing schools and colleges and hospitals. The holiness movement led the way in trying to let our light shine so that we could do things for other people. The holiness movement led the way in trying to make prisons more humane. They followed literally the teachings of Jesus to feed the hungry and clothe the naked and visit the prisoner and heal the sick. That was a part of the holiness movement. So holiness involved both your personal life but also your social life and how you acted toward others, particularly those who were suffering. That was all a part of the holiness movement. And the holiness movement was very strong on foreign missions, primarily to bring grace and help to people who lived in other places to improve their lives. My wife went to a college in China that was started by the Methodist Church, by people who were deep in the holiness part of the Methodist Church. So now, the holiness movement, like I say, from 1840s on, it affected individual churches, mostly Methodist, Evangelical, and United Brethren. And probably 40 to 50% of all Methodist, Evangelical, and United Brethren churches were dominated with the ethos of the holiness movement through many, many years. In fact, when I was in Southern Illinois, if a church had two Methodist churches in it, one was a holiness Methodist and the other was sort of a derogatorily called a clubbish Methodist church. And the holiness movement especially affected from New York through Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio. Those were the areas where the holiness movement was the strongest. And remember, we were part of the evangelical church. And I've been reading the history of our church, and I've been listening to people, and one of the things that's very clear to me is that there's a strong identification in Grace Church with the holiness movement. It's kind of come and gone. Now, what happened to the holiness movement? And I think it's important to realize that while holiness is biblical, and it's how I came to know Christ, and it's at the heart of what I believe it means to be a Christian, and it's fundamental to what I believe a pastor needs to do to lead a church, is to make these things evident to everybody. The holiness movement also has its problems. You've heard the phrase, holier than thou. It's very easy when your emphasis is holiness to get snooty about it. It's very easy to become judgmental of other people. It's very easy to single out other people's sins and not realize that I might be just as bad, if not worse, doing damage for the ways that I'm not perfect. The holiness movement also has a church politics tinge to it. There are people in the holiness movement who want to have power that they can't get in the more established churches. And so they realized that the way to power might be to organize a group of people under the guise of holiness. There's a lot of politics goes on underneath the surface of things. We began in the history of American religion to realize that the holiness movement was not sufficient for a number of people. For example, and I'm speaking generally here, the fundamentalists, what are known as fundamentalists, pulled out of the, separated themselves from the holiness movement because they believed that more emphasis should be put on correct doctrine and correct interpretation. And so they began to carry out arguments of how you think and insisting on conformity, that we all think the same way about how to read the Bible or how to interpret the Bible. So the fundamentalists kind of went that way. Pentecostals, by and large, began to feel like even the holiness people had lost their pizzazz, had lost their heart. John Wesley used to say that faith is a matter of the head and the heart. And so Pentecostals began to get frustrated with the normal holiness movement because there was not enough joy and not enough enthusiasm, not enough openness to experiencing all the different gifts of the Holy Spirit. And so they began to split off. It's one of the reasons I keep agitating you for being so dull in worship on Sunday morning. So, because good holiness religion is of the head and the heart. And I want to see the heart here when we worship together more. But the Pentecostals kind of split off. And then there were arguments within Methodist, Evangelical, and United Brethren churches that people said, no, we need to be more sophisticated and more worldly so we get people in from the community. And then the religious right began to have its own agenda, which became very, very political. And it split off from the holiness movement, and they kind of had their own thing, which was fundamentally a political agenda. And then the religious left kind of split off because while they became passionate again about political issues on the left, they began to lose their spiritual roots. So both the religious right and the religious left have kind of left Jesus behind. And it doesn't matter anymore on the religious right or the religious left whether you're living your life, your conduct is the light of Christ shining through you. That didn't matter anymore. The politics became more important. And then there was the rise of TV and radio religion. And I always used to be irritated with TV preachers because I thought there's something not quite right going on here about this. And it wasn't until the COVID hit and I had to become a TV preacher that I realized that I had to do things that when you're on video, and I also became a radio preacher down in Salem when I was there for that year. When you become a radio preacher or when you become a TV preacher, the medium itself demands certain ways of acting and doing things. And I found myself more conscious of trying to hold an audience than I was of the kinds of things that I would normally do if I just had a group of people in front of me. So TV and religion kind of diluted the holiness movement. And then the church growth movement diluted it. Because in order to grow, we're willing to suspend almost all of our standards because we're desperate to fill these empty spots. And we see our numbers that are looking a little shaky. And so the church growth movement learned to sort of put holiness in the background because we thought that would be offensive to people. So all of these things are happening. And by the time I entered ministry in the early 70s, the holiness movement was pretty well flat. And here, that was my training. That was my upbringing. That was how I came to faith. And yet, I barely found any of it. Just a person here, a person there in the churches where I've served. But that's our heritage. That's who we are. Now, I want to finish this sermon by asking you to consider what it means to be holiness, what it means to remember who we are. We came from a very strong holiness tradition, and it was very powerful in this church for many, many years. And there are reasons that it declined. And it wasn't all bad, because some of the reasons, as I said, holiness could get kind of ornery and kind of unchristlike, ironically, when the whole purpose is to let Christ shine through our conduct. We're in the process of redoing our website. And I was looking at other websites in town, and almost all of the websites have this section saying, "Who are we? Click here. Who are we?" And I'm thinking, okay, we'll put one of those on our website. Who are we? And then I thought, okay, what am I going to put on who are we? And then I realized that, you know, there's a lot of similarity between, in fact, the two terms kind of go together, holiness and grace. If you leave grace out of holiness, then all you have is holier than thou and judgmentalism. If you leave holiness out of grace, then all you have is wishy-washy. And so I thought, what I want to do on the website is to say, we are a group of people from a holiness tradition trying to live our lives, trying to live up to our name. We are a community with deep roots in the holiness tradition, and we're trying to live up to the name of our church, Grace. And if you stop and think about grace, grace is when somebody loves you and you know you didn't deserve it. Grace is when you suddenly experience something joyful or something that makes you laugh or something that makes you feel warm and you didn't even know where it came from. You weren't expecting it. Grace is when someone is patient with you when you knew you deserved to be slapped or at least scolded, and they're patient with you. Grace is when you feel a sense of peace inside yourself and you can't fathom where it came from. It's beyond your understanding. That's grace. Grace is when someone is gentle with you or kind, and it's been so long since anybody was gentle or kind with you. Grace is when somebody talks to you and they see something in you that you didn't see in yourself, but they see it and they affirm it. That's grace. And so, as I'm trying to understand who we are, and I've been talking with people, this is our first month together. We've got five to go, and it's going to get busier and busier as we go. This was the easy month. But as I've been learning about this church, as I've been getting acquainted with people, the one thing that strikes me in this church is across the board, a yearning for holiness. You might not have said it in the way I said it this morning, but I see throughout this church a desire that the light of Christ shine through our lives and through who we are collectively. I've noticed an embarrassment that we've gone through periods where, as a group, the light of Christ, people weren't seeing it because we were so busy quarreling. so busy thinking about how we're divided, how we're different, how we're unhappy. And I've seen across this church embarrassment and a realization that we are not going to be that way anymore. There's a yearning in this church to be holy, to get in touch with our roots, so that the light of Christ can come shine through us, so that we can be a blessing to others in our church and in our community. I've seen that yearning for holiness here. And that's one reason I'm so excited to be the pastor of this church. The other thing I've seen is grace. Such graciousness. I mean, I started out this worship service by saying I'm not the one who screwed up the technology. And nobody walked out because I used that word. I wrote about toilets the other day in my daily letter to you. Nobody canceled their subscription. I've come in here and asked you to change your rules. And some of you have said, okay, but you can change the rules, but don't, you know, don't destroy this and don't destroy that. I found nothing but grace in this church from the moment I arrived, of people who treat me better than I deserve to be treated, who unquestionably have supported me and come to listen to me and participated in my workshops and gathered when I've asked people to work together. Grace upon grace. Y'all didn't have to do any of that. This is a church that yearns to live up to its name, individually and collectively. As I was working on this sermon, it helped me figure out what I want to put on the website. We are a people with deep roots in the holiness tradition who yearn to live up to the full meaning of our name, grace. Sing with me, the gift of love, because that's what is at the heart of grace. It is...